WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911, offering the finest assortment of Easter candy from Fannie Mae, Russell Stover, and more. Treat your family to the very best. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I am Gregory Berg, excited about this morning show today. We are going to be talking about the very, very good work, the hard work, the also very satisfying, life-changing work that is done by the Racine Vocational Ministries Organization, which is headed up by Executive Director James Schatzman. We've talked to Jim Schatzman on a number of occasions, but mostly, most often, about his work with the Choral Arts Society of Southeastern Wisconsin. I think only once or twice have we actually talked about Jim's day job, which is as Director of Racine Vocational Ministries, which is an organization that does a tremendous amount of good in the community, trying to help people who find themselves sort of on the outside looking in, trying to find a way into healthy and productive lives with good work that allows them to sustain themselves and their families. And joining us also today are two of the people on the staff of Racine Vocational Ministries, Lori Life, who is program director there, involved in the areas of life skills and job placement, and then Sammy Rangel, who is program director for a sort of subset of RVM, which is called Second Chance, which deals specifically in trying to give second chances to those who have been incarcerated. A warm welcome to all three of you. We're so glad to have all of you here.
Thank you.
Jim Schatzman, when was it that you became involved with Racine Vocational Ministries? I know once upon a time you did something else and then kind of took this different direction. And, of course, it's been a real exciting, gratifying change for you. When did that happen?
It happened around 2000. I was on a committee at my church, actually, and they said we wanted to do something with our building and other than just hold church services. And so started looking around at other programs, talking to people. And came across a program in Milwaukee called Abundant Life Ministry, which was a back-to-work program. It was funded by the Lutheran Church, and got to know Tom, the director there, and talked to him. And we did some feasibility studying in Racine, and as most of our listeners will know, Racine has led the state in unemployment for, I think, almost 30 straight quarters, with the rare exception when the GM plant in Janesville shut down. They leapt over us for only about 2 months, and then we were back leading again. Janesville recovered. Jobs in Racine has been a tough situation for a very long time. And so in early 2000, we started a group to study the issue, look for grant opportunities, study what they did in Milwaukee, and to create a practice in Racine that would work. And it took us about 2 years. In August of 2002, we opened our doors for the first time with two employees and an $80,000 budget. And these many years later, we now have 10 employees and about a little over $500,000 budget.
So when you began work on this, was it with the intention or expectation that you were going to be an active part of this and, in fact, the director of it? I mean, at what point did this start to envelop you to that extent, that this wasn't just an issue you were concerned about as a citizen, but you were going to be a real hands-on participant in whatever was created?
That's a really good question, and it's kind of circuitous. I mean, I was part of a committee that was really looking at ways to effectively use our church building in the community to make a difference. And basically, we were looking at programs to come in. And when we talked to Tom initially, the idea is that we would franchise that business into Racine, and I might be on the board, or I might have served on a transition committee and then moved on to something else. Luck would have it, franchising opportunity began to stall down with the board of Abundant Life in Milwaukee. And Tom, who had been very active at that point, just looked at me and he said, "You could do this."
Hmm.
And I said, "Yeah, I think I could." And I suppose I'd become emotionally attached to it after, you know, 2 years of really working in the nitty-gritty, talking to funders, talking to potential clients, and how we might build the services. And the committee looked at me and said, "Are you willing to run with this?" And I said, "Let's go."
Hmm.
And so that's kind of what happened. It happened gradually over 2 years' time.
Right. And I should think that, I mean, some people sort of work all their lives, live out their whole lives in the world of social agencies, mm-hmm. and are just kind of used to being part of something which you're doing. But, of mm-hmm. course, for you, you worked at InSinkErator for a
second. I did.
I mean, great company. But,
yep.
but I mean, it had to feel like a drastic shift of mission, in a sense, for you to be suddenly doing work like this.
Absolutely. And it was a pragmatic pretty odd shift as well, because you leave corporate life to raise your own funds month by month, sometimes week by week. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a shift from corporate America, where you put your time in and you get a check and you get insurance and you don't think anything about it. You just go to work every day. But the other side of that is, you know, you get a chance to work with people and to see lives changed, and to see to get a chance to be in a position to have people trust you with their aspirations and their goals in life, and in many cases just to resurrect dreams that have long been sold and put away in a drawer because they just didn't seem practical.
Let's talk about what Racine Vocational Ministries was as it was mm-hmm. created, mm-hmm. as it when you first opened your doors on a relatively modest scale back in 2002, and then talk about what has come into being since mm-hmm. then as you managed to expand.
We really were built on the model, and actually very close on the model of Abundant Life Ministry in Milwaukee, which was giving people who have either situational or chronic poverty an opportunity to get back on their feet, and that revolved around getting back to work. As we began to learn in the business, and certainly heard from our mentor early on, what was going to get in the way of people getting back on their feet was not necessarily income or lack of income, but a lack of life skill, a lack of an ability to engage in ways that are pro-social, in ways that companies will respect, in ways that will kind of respect themselves too, give themselves an opportunity to grow. A lot of that revolved around education. Another kind of piece of the leg of employment is having the not only the soft skills, as we call them, but the hard skills, being able to manage the language, being able to manage reading, whether it's a memo or a job description, being able to compete in an interview by managing your language while knowing what employers want, by not looking too terribly desperate, but knowing mm-hmm. that you have something to offer to that company. These are fairly, and I learned early on, these are fairly sophisticated skills, and not everybody has them.
Right. And of course, I just hasten to add, even people who aren't necessarily the most desperate sort of mm-hmm. people in the most desperate of circumstances still find themselves. I mean, plenty of 55-year-olds who suddenly find themselves out of work mm-hmm. Find that this can be a terribly difficult quandary to be in. Like, for instance,
yes.
not looking too desperate and that urgently needing and wanting this job desperately. What do you do with that?
Well, there was a very interesting dynamic when we started that we've grown past that just because of time. But when I started, we had dozens of Vietnam vets who had gotten a job at their buddy's company, and their buddy's dad's company, and then their buddy's dad went out of business. And they had never interviewed for a job. They had a very low-skill job, like sweeping a warehouse, and they were making pretty darn good money. And as you know, in 2000, a lot of things began to change. Wages for entry-level workers has remained flat for decades, and has actually gone backwards a little bit in terms of real buying power. And so these guys came in desperate, you know, being able to support themselves all their lives, and now they can't compete for jobs because they didn't get their high school diploma, or they didn't learn any job skills. They were really stuck. And that was kind of some of my first clients that I worked with back then. But it's changed a lot. I no longer work with clients. The agency's grown. Lori's taken on more responsibility. We've added a prisoner reentry program that is large, sophisticated, and extremely well-respected in the industry. And so we've gone from just helping people get back to work to really expanding the portion below that, which is the foundation people stand in, is how solid is your life, how solid is your understanding of how to engage the world around you, and, you know, what do you really aspire to do? We can get you started, but a starter job is not always that aspirational job that you hope for, that aspirational life that you're looking for.
So was it then and is it now an agency that requires anything in particular in order for someone to qualify to receive the services that you have to offer?
It's very interesting. This may be a chance to hand it off to one of the other folks, too. When we started, it was just, y'all come. Who's ever out there, come on in. And a part of our programming is still like that. But we now have programs that serve the homeless, that serve specifically local gang populations. We have a program that just serves people coming out of prison with the kind of caveat that they have to be on supervision and they have to be they're trying very hard to, and our grantors are expecting that we will connect with them before they're released from prison. And so maybe Sammy could talk a little bit about that piece and how his clients come to his program.
So most of our participants who come to Second Chance have to fit a very small criteria, but it's a very rigid criteria. So one, they're coming back to Racine. They have to be low or medium to high risk on an evaluation that is given by corrections. Medium to high risk doesn't necessarily mean they will violate, but it means that they have enough indicators on that assessment that show that they have some risks or needs that put them at high risk, that hopefully if addressed through a program, through collaborative case planning with corrections and with our agency, that we may be able to drive some of those risks and needs down, which should improve or increase the opportunity to make it once they exit prison and reenter the community. And so one of the criteria on top of that is that all of our clients are also voluntary. So although I call it a requirement, it's different from other models that are out there where most of the participants are mandated to participate in programming. And I would say that we have a fairly decent retention rate and show rate, even for a program where you're typically dealing with people who are who cannot see or do not want to see the benefit of engaging in some type of social program. And so in the face of that, we say, well, what is it that's driving, you know, our success in that rate? And I think it has a lot to do with, the climate of the entire agency and how we're looking at and serving the people of our community. Two, we have highly skilled professionals in these positions now and have for some time, but we're really focusing on improving those soft and hard skills of our staff to be more efficient and I think more up to date with current models that are showing promise, that show movement forward towards change and maybe even recovery for some people. And I think the last piece is that we really focus on relationships with the participants that we have. I say it's relationships before goals, before program. If you don't have the relationship, no matter how good of a service that you're selling or providing, people won't want to participate in it. And so I think that speaks to why RVM, and including Second Chance, is seeing some of the success that we have.
I was really struck, especially by the very first thing you said, that the people you deal with are people who, in a sense, have red flags attached to their names. Mm-hmm. And I think about other situations where, I mean, if I was in a position to hire five guys and I was going to choose from this prison population, I would probably do just the opposite. I would look for the ones with the cleanest records and the richest sort of promise.
Sure.
And probably towards the bottom of the list would be the people with red flags where there were reasons for concern. And, of course, that, of course, flies in the face of what your program's all about. It's exactly about confronting those, in a sense, risky cases.
Absolutely.
And trying to do whatever you can to help them avoid the pitfalls that you fear might befall them.
Absolutely. And to be fair to our community is also invested in second chances. I mean, Racine County is pretty forgiving. And as long as you're putting effort and energy out there and you're showing some consistency, they tend to open their doors sooner than later. Say that in a broad spectrum. You know, of course, there's individuals out there who may have barriers in place that make it hard for someone to reenter. But we have over 50 stakeholders at our table who are interested in seeing these gentlemen and these women make it and make it successfully. And I mean, like, successful collaborations where this isn't really a program. This isn't an initiative. There are many people in the county and in our city who are vested and interested in seeing these men and women succeed. And from federal prosecutors who are responsible for the eastern border of Wisconsin to your DEA, Homeland Security, we have our technical assistant people in Washington, D.C. We've got every key player in Racine that you can imagine. We have the regional chief from corrections, the chief of police, the county executive, the mayor. I mean, and it just trickles all the way down to the bottom. And so when we talk about a program, that's just one small piece of what Second Chance really is all about. Second Chance is looking at this global collective of issues and barriers and risks and needs that drive recidivism. We don't say that to be successful, it's all on the client. We realize that as stakeholders, we have to take some responsibility and clear a path for men and women that we want to reenter into this community so that they can be successful. And of course, it's difficult, but I think our program actually has some teeth to it. We can get doors open that have been historically or typically closed. We can bring and get people to the table who have typically not wanted to be there. And we're also recruiting people from the community on a one-on-one level, too. So we're getting business owners and renters and other people at the table faster and longer because they see the benefit of what we're doing. I mean, ultimately, this is a public safety issue at the very core of its nature. Mm-hmm. And so when we address public safety, I think that's what brings everyone to the table because everyone is affected by crime. Everyone is affected by broken families, by poverty in some way, shape, or form. It doesn't even matter what spectrum you're on or if you're blue or red. Everyone is affected by that. And so I think that's what interests people in what we're doing.
Right. It matters to everybody. It's absolutely Nothing where you have to really rev up people's interest or concern.
Absolutely.
We're speaking today on the morning show about Racine Vocational Ministries. With us, we've been speaking just now with Sammy Rangel, who is program director for Second Chance, which is one component of the Racine Vocational Ministries. Also with us is Lori Life, who is program director with the business of life skills and job placement and so on. And also joining us is the boss himself, James Schatzman, executive director of RVM. So, Lori Life, it sounds like you are one of the people who sits across the table from people who find themselves sometimes in this really desperate situation and so anxious to find their way into, in a sense, the working world. First of all, do you work with some of the clients that Sammy Rangel was just talking about, or is that kind of a separate component of the program?
Kind of a separate component.
Pull that a little closer to you and tell me then who are the kind of clients that you directly work with?
Well, we work with anyone who typically does not qualify for the Second Chance program. We work with low-risk offenders as well as serving our homeless populations, people experiencing homelessness, victims of domestic violence, anyone who is underemployed or unemployed that typically does not fit the Second Chance program model.
Okay. What do you find are the most pressing issues when you sit down and work with clients? What are the most significant areas of, let's call it deficiency, for lack of a better word? Maybe you can supply a better word, but those, for instance, soft skills that Jim earlier was talking about that some people really lack and which really make a difference. What do you most often see?
I think for me, what I see generally is that people want to go to work kind of before they're even prepared to go to work. They're ready to get a job. There's a need to get some employment. Life dictates that they need to have some job or some income coming in, and yet I've noticed that one particular soft skill is lacking more than another. It's just generally kind of the soft skills themselves that are lacking. People are not able to navigate through some of the core. One of the things you said, that sometimes what people aren't able to navigate through is some of the core concerns that an employer might have regarding their barriers. And so, you know, they may be able to do a job application. They might be able to start an interview, but somehow they get to that interview or the employer looked at that application and that employer sees those things that would cause a red flag. You know, be it someone who's an ex-offender or someone who just has potentially a lot of gaps in employment, now those red flags are there. And so how do we help someone get through those red flags and be able to address those concerns with an employer? Hmm.
And I suppose part of the issue is if we're talking with someone where this is the only life they know, mm-hmm. they have no way to even imagine all that they don't possess in terms of understanding and life skills and so on. I mean, they don't even know what is missing from the package. Right. I suppose that makes it really difficult then in terms of the work that you do to have to sometimes maybe even convince people that you are lacking something that we can give you.
Yes.
Have you been in our office?
No, I can kind of imagine it maybe, but... Okay.
Okay. Yes. What you see is people who come in and what's the old phrase? You don't know what you don't know.
Yeah.
And as you try to help somebody to understand, you know, that they're not job ready when they're desperate for income. Mm. There's two dynamics going on. First of all, the desperation of the client and the impact that can have on two people talking to each other. You're talking about social service people who want to help. You know, we are trained to be problem solvers and very nurturing about how that might happen. And yet, you know that if you throw somebody into the lake before they can swim, you're not really helping them. You're actually going to create yet another barrier they're going to have to work through, yet another employment situation that they're going to be, they're going to have to explain why it didn't work to the next employer. They're going to have another failure that they, that they themselves have to work through and try and sort through. And I can tell you that for every person that we saw who was ready to work, we probably see 50 who have a hornet's nest, a bird's nest of issues, all wrapped together and entangled, most of which the client doesn't see.
Right.
Because they assume... because they can't make their house payment or their electricity is going to be cut off or they're going to lose their car or their furniture is going to be repossessed or they're homeless and they're desperate to get out of the shelter because their family's split up on the men and women's side and they just want to get back together. That if you can – and we hear it over and over. If you can just get me a job, I'll get out of your hair. I won't worry about – you won't have to worry about me anymore. I'll be fine. We know that's not the case. Mm. It just doesn't happen.
Wow.
So,
and you know, I'm so glad you pointed that out about how it can some ways, because I think the rhetoric is often you just need to get out there, get a job, and just get in the working world. And the trouble is that when you thrust somebody into a situation in which they are almost destined to fail, that failure is not something maybe they can easily leave behind. I mean, there's a real cost to that, particularly if someone is sort of in a already desperate situation with none of the sort of cushion that allows a lot of the rest of us to maybe put a reversal behind us.
And we're not Chicago. There's not, thousands of jobs out there that if you fail, you can go to another part of town. Nobody will know you. Mm. And you can just kind of get in. Racine is very networked and very tightly knit together. And so too many failures in one area make it harder and harder to begin to make your way forward. And so a lot of what Lori does is what my mentor said, is helping clients, and I'm sure Sammy can talk about this too, it's helping the clients to begin to operate with a calm mind. they come in and their thoughts are racing and they don't move through to conclusion. They're all jumbled, and it's just that desperation. And think of it like drowning. You know, you're just trying to get your next breath, and that next breath may feel like a check or a, you know, a some kind of a support for their housing or their car payment or their phone payment, or can't you just give me a job and I'll leave you alone? It doesn't really work that way. And
right.
So what Lori does is she offers a training course called Solutions for Success. It's a four-day training course that is in four kind of core areas, and I'd like to have Lori talk a little bit about the training class, which where people do begin to calm down and they do begin to realize, oh, it's more than just filling out an application.
And so in the 4 days, we cover a lot of some of the life skills issues and topics, and that includes understanding the U.S. business culture. So giving people an idea of what employers may expect from them. We also talk in detail about conflict resolution and the need to get along well in the workplace, as well as getting along, you know, with family and friends, and learning how to deal more pro-socially in your community as well. We talk about developing what's called a good answer for gaps in employment. That's such a necessary piece, because most of our people that come to our doors have some sort of criminal background, some areas that may cause an employer concerns, some maybe gaps in employment that would potentially otherwise, if unaddressed, would probably put them as a candidate that's at the bottom of the list.
Right, be pretty much a deal breaker.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Interesting. This brings to mind something I hadn't thought of before. To what extent is there also, in a sense, rehabilitation that needs to happen on the side of employers? That is, bringing them into the picture, opening them up to the possibility that someone that may have, in a sense, red flags attached to their name, who at a glance might not seem to be the optimal candidate for a given job, in fact, should be maybe more carefully, thoughtfully considered. Is it set up at all that you are also interacting with potential employers in that way, or do you just have to hope that employers out there are going to find it in their hearts, collective corporate hearts, to think about this?
In the corporate world, there's not a lot of thought for what they can do for their communities as much as what the individual can do for the company. And so people are quickly screened out. But as Sammy talked about earlier, same way with our business partners and our second chance partners, it's about relationship. And so we are routinely seeking out employers when we come across them. Sammy's masterful at this. If he's in a restaurant and he's talking to the owner, if he's buying cleaning supplies, he's talking to the owner of that company or the manager of that outfit and letting them know. And that's really how it is. It's about reaching out to employers and letting them know that this population has another side to it. And one of them is that when a lot of our clients get an opportunity, they really overperform. They want to make sure that this employer knows that they're, first of all, grateful that they've gotten the position and that they want to prove that they're well. I would often say to some of my clients, you know, you're our Jackie Robinson here. You know, you're going to go in and there are going to be issues you're going to confront in the shop. We need you to take the high road on everything, work very hard, make friends, you know, be a part of the team, find a way to be a part of the team, which is part of what Lori's teaching them and Sammy's teaching the clients, to be a part of the team. Find a way to make that happen. And Sammy, you've brought a couple employers on board since we started. You could talk about that and how your clients are responding to those kinds of things.
It's quite a challenge sometimes to have an employer be open-minded enough to get over their fear. It's typically fear that's the first response, like, you know, what am I getting into? You know, and of course they should be mindful and thoughtful of that. But then again, you know, we still have to try to win people over. And I think the way that we do that is, one, we're very transparent with our employers, but we also assure them that, and this is something that's very critical, we're really not an employment seeking agency, so to speak. That's something that we do after we address some front-end issues, right? We get to that. We don't start at that. And I think that's quite a different spin for our participants as well as for what the community thinks that we're about. If a person doesn't have, the mind calmness to engage in the workforce, we have to stabilize that, and so we might spend some weeks or months dealing with that before we even start to talk about employment. So we're reassuring our companies and our business owners that we're not just sending someone cold turkey out of the system to you. We've done a lot of prep work. We've done a lot of front end work. And this person, in a sense, for lack of a better term, has to kind of prove themselves to be ready for engagement in the community. Although we're talking about employment, these men and women are actually talking about kind of like establishing a basis with the community to prove that they're ready, that they've made some changes, that they can be trusted, and hopefully can be a worthy person in that company or that position.
Hmm. So in a sense, when they come through your program, at the end of it, I guess ideally, it's almost as though they bear this like good housekeeping seal of approval. I mean that it means something very tangible. In fact, when they come through your program, is there sort of a moment where you go ka-chunk and they pass or they are certified? Or I mean, does it work in that way at all?
Absolutely. And because we're really upfront with our participants from the very beginning, and because they'll come, I need a job, I need this, I need that. And we're like, we'll get to that. And that they kind of double take because they think that's the starting point. We say, actually, that's the finish line. We're on the opposite end of those things. And that's not unusual in clinical world where your goals are way over here and your participants' goals are way over there. And then you hope to meet in the middle somewhere. That's pretty common. But I do believe that when we see some consistency, you see them being resilient in their positions in life. A lot of them have to manage very difficult relationships with their POs, with their family, with their community. And it's not so much that they can solve those problems, it's that they can endure those problems well. It's a concept that I've introduced to them, which is called suffering well, as opposed to suffering poor. An example of suffering poor is giving up, maybe going to drinking or using or just checking out and going back to the way things were. And suffering well is you're enduring your adversity. You do take the high road when you're in the face of unfairness or some inequality that even though you know in your mind and your heart that this is unfair, you still took the high road. And so those are kind of, we're saying these are at down the road, this is what it's going to look like when you're ready. And then they have a goal. They have an idea of what they're aiming for. And then it's case by case situation, but I would say, you're looking at 2 or 3 months minimum of effort and work with most of our cases. One, you don't come out of prison ready to engage in life. That's a misnomer. There's nothing about your prison experience that prepares you to engage out here. Nothing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them come out here thinking, I'm ready. And then when you start to reveal with them and they start to discover for themselves these hurdles, these barriers that they didn't even know were out there or inside of them, they kind of learn the value of slowing down. They understand the value of taking our time and getting this right so that we're not setting them up for failure again. And that's often been the thing. Like we ramp people up on their exit from prison, like, okay, go get them, Tiger. And yet we haven't given them what they need, or they don't have what they need in a sense to actually go get them. Right. And so they're because they haven't really had the support to foster resiliency or consistency yet, they'll give it their all, but then quickly will fail. And then it will look to the community like this person isn't sincere or this person was manipulating. And in reality, it's hard to understand what you need and you're fully engaged out here. And that's kind of where our RVM comes in, where we're saying we kind of can see down your road. We can kind of predict for you what's going to happen and what you're going to need in this situation. What do you think? And then they partner with you to do that. And then they start to trust in your guidance and your insight and your foresight a little bit. And then we have found that they're willing to slow down. Hmm. They're willing to understand that there is some development that is necessary to engage in that program.
Hmm. This is a question for both of you and Jim too, but I guess I start with you, Sammy, because when we're talking about people who are criminals who've been convicted of some kind of crime, on some level, most criminal activity involves some kind of dishonesty. So I wonder if you could just say a word about that core principle of honesty, particularly when it comes to certain people who have been down a road in which their life is a web of one deceit after another. And what's it like to work with people like that, with that sort of history? And what does it take for you, for instance, to see through the deceit, to see actually who they really are, and to engage them on a level which is going to ultimately really be life-changing?
So you make me think about some things. I travel the country training other service providers all the time, and one of the things that always kind of takes me back a little bit, and I do get a little upset or frustrated because I am human, you know, when I'm working with somebody who is in a position of authority or power. When I signed up for this job, I knew exactly the personality I would be dealing with, and I signed up to deal with that personality on purpose. It wasn't an accident. I didn't accidentally fall into working with this population. I knew what I wanted to do, and I had a choice to make, and I made that choice. There are some service providers who would find it offensive or feel as if this isn't working when they see those type of traits, you know, somebody who's being dishonest or manipulative or inconsistent. Me knowing that those are some of the symptoms and traits that my population may bring with them, I have to be accepting of that, and I have to communicate that I accept that, that I understand the dynamic. Not that it's acceptable. I still set healthy limits and boundaries, but I'm not going to judge them when they manifest the symptoms that can predict quite accurately that they have. I understand that, and quite honestly, because I understand that, I can talk about it openly, but in a way that isn't judgmental. The only way to make a change in the population that we're working with, and this is, I think, across the board in any population you work with, is with compassion and empathy. If you cannot express as a professional compassion and empathy for whatever your participants or your clients or your patients show or manifest, you're in the wrong position. The clients may not be able to see in the beginning that that they're still employing old tactics and strategies. But eventually, as your strategy starts to work in this intervention with these people and they start to develop more awareness, more consciousness, then they start to realize just how deep your acceptance of them runs, because you didn't judge them, you didn't kick them out, you didn't terminate them for showing these symptoms, you didn't act as if you were a correctional officer or law enforcement. You continue to treat them with your humanity as human beings, and then that's when they start to buy in to the relationship, which means that just about anything you're about to talk about after that point is meaningful to them, and then they start to become more honest, more transparent. They start to reveal more of their weaknesses, more of their deficiencies, because now they have the trust. Now they realize that you've done whatever you can to win them over, including accept the very worst of them. And, you know, there is that saying that if you can't accept me at my worst, you don't deserve me at my best. I think that qualifies for our participants. Whatever they show you, you have to be understanding as a professional. You have to be patient as a professional. And I think you have to express your compassion and empathy. Really, a lie isn't just a lie. You could look at it that way, but a lie may be an indicator that there's more work to be done to establish the relationship that may make it possible for this person to lower their guard and then to open up to you.
Lori Life, I mean, these issues we're talking about are not by any means limited to the population that Sammy deals with. How much is this a paramount concern of yours, and how much of what Sammy's talking about rings true for you?
I agree wholeheartedly with Sammy, you know, in the sense that we do get people that come in and, you know, many times they are afraid to kind of share their stories. They're kind of afraid to share their hearts. I shared with Jim the other day, I have the saying with people that says, if I show you my nakedness, will you make me feel ashamed? And so that's kind of a foundation that I kind of work off of. People are coming, you know, they want to share, they want to change. Many times they have that desire to change, but being able to kind of share some of their hardest points or their hardest stories makes it really, really difficult for them to be vulnerable and truthful with us initially. But what we do find is that as we do establish that relationship with the participant or with the person, then they're able to kind of open up and be vulnerable and let us in, and we can help walk with them on that journey to some wholeness.
And there's a part of the model that we're working in that is taking advantage of a lot of new science, but is really rooted in the compassion and empathy that Sammy's talking about. Our clients coming to us, walking in the door, they've admitted already that something's wrong. Something's not working. I know I need help. I can't do this alone. It is really counterproductive to spend your first couple of meetings with them telling them how broken they are and how they're never going to make it if they don't change. They know that already.
So, in other words, they wouldn't be there if on some level they didn't see themselves as having screwed up or messed up something on a really important level. They wouldn't have walked in the door otherwise.
And then if they come before you and you reinforce that, you know, you're reinforcing the worst in them. Their guard goes back up again, and then you're in a tussle. You find yourself in a tussle. They're going to get as much as they can for as little as they have to give. And the dynamic is upside down. It's backwards. And so one of the things we do to help keep those walls down is that whoever gets a new client, that client is introduced to everybody in the agency. After their first couple appointments, they're coming back through, hi, this is Jim, he's our director, you know, this is the guy who signs the check that helps you get your bus pass, you know, or whatever. We joke and talk and try to be genuine in letting them know that we really care about them. And if Sammy happens to be out and they need something, somebody will be there to take care of them. If Lori has asked them to come back and she ends up being sick, somebody will take care of you. You're not going to be alone when you come here. And it's part of developing a good pro-social behavior and attitude to help people learn how to shake hands, to help them learn how to ask questions of people they don't know very well, to begin to trust on a certain level, because many of the population that comes to us, they trust almost nobody. And
with good reason.
With good reason. And so we're trying to build a small network at the agency of trust that they can begin to carry some of those learnings into their families, into their networks of employment, into their networks of social service, that they begin trusting people who are in the helping professions so that they can maximize that help all the way.
Hmm. That being said, I find myself compelled to ask Sammy about the notion of tough love when we're talking about your specific clientele. I mean, I think when we try to imagine what these interactions are like, part of where our imagination goes is into having to sometimes really kind of lay down the law for people who and be very honest and maybe sometimes even brutally frank.
Sure.
when they are not in fact doing what they're supposed to be doing. How often does that happen, or does compassion end up being the predominant flavor of these interactions for the most part?
So I'm looking in the room, and I think everyone here is old enough to remember Sheridan Road or Highway 32 being the road that we used to take to Chicago from here.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of the road of tough love. It's outdated. It's not very many people are going to be using that highway to get all the way from Milwaukee to Chicago anymore.
A lot of stop signs.
You have a much better path through 94, you know, some options maybe through 41, but even 41 is outdated, right? And so in a sense, tough love really, without getting too far ahead of myself, it evokes parentalness. And so many of our participants don't have healthy relationships with their parents. So if I'm evoking the image of a parental figure in their minds, I'm only helping them dig in. And this, as Jim was talking, this is what I would attribute to what we're doing. I imagine the undertaking that it is to have someone try to help you change your global view, your world view. That's what I've been tasked to do. Help this person change the way they think about everything.
Right.
That's a huge undertaking. And I'll be honest with you, tough love will get you compliance, but it won't get you change, which is a very different thing. And what happens with compliance is that once the supervision is gone, they resort typically back to the way things used to be. But when you're trying to get long-term change, I think you have to help a person change their worldview, not just their behavior. And too many times up to this point, programs have been measuring behavioral change as opposed to maybe, for lack of a better term, a moral change or, you know, a moral shift in their compass. And so we're actually trying to get a person to shift their global view about the world. When Jim talked about getting the participants to trust us, and Lori talked about that, it's not just trusting anyone. They trust people. There's people in their worlds that they trust, but people like us is difficult because we represent the system. And the system, as we know, has good parts, but it has bad parts. And a lot of these participants remember the bad parts, and they can't help but compare us to that. And so that's why we think that our standards, our practice, are really helping us get there faster. It doesn't take very long for us to have the relationship with the people that we're helping for them to start shifting their narrative, shifting their worldview, because they feel the genuineness in our interaction.
Lori Life, that brings to mind one other thing I wanted to ask. We just have a minute or two left. The question of when you're sitting down with someone to, in a sense, not be condescending, to not be insulting.
Yes.
I mean, even though, in a sense, part of the understanding is you've made a lot of mistakes. You don't really have it all together. We can help you. But how does one convey that message, in a sense, without, in a sense, demeaning the person you're wanting to help?
And I think for me, typically, in the intake process, I just try to reassure people that many of the questions that we have are tough questions, but those questions are not designed to belittle in any way. They're kind of help designed to get us to the core of something, to help that person maybe develop a success plan for themselves, and then you know, help us, again, to kind of walk along with them on the journey of where they're trying to go and what they're trying to accomplish. And I think once we've talked a little bit here today about buy-in, once that person gets a sense that we're genuine in what we say and what we're trying to accomplish with them, they seem to be okay for the most part with kind of sharing those details and opening the door to let us in on some other things that are pretty sensitive issues in their lives.
Well, that says a lot about what you're managing to accomplish and the relationships you're building, if to whatever extent that's true, because that's pretty an amazing thing to occur between two human beings.
There's a really important point to that, too, that to kind of flesh that out. We have worked very, very hard to hire staff who understand their own flaws. When you come to a client not as the expert who's never had a problem and who's always had their lives together, but you're able to share, you don't want to be graphic necessarily with the details of our problems, but, you know, none of us comes to this work flawless. We're all flawed in some ways. And when we begin to share from that platform that there's an equality of it, we're all on a journey towards a better life, no matter where we are in that continuum. We just may be a little farther along the path at this time.
Or we've been luckier.
I
mean, or both.
Or both. You know, that may be another part of our story at some show, to have these folks tell you that their walk to where they are today was not easy. And I look for staff who have that ability to empathize, that ability to understand that their walk to the point to where they are has not been easy either. And they're going to share that in a way that creates, that levels the playing field of understanding. And that's where people begin to relax and trust. They know, oh, they've been there to some degree. They understand what I'm going through. And now we can talk about it as peers, not as somebody who has no clue what's ever happened in my life.
Wow. That's very well put. So if people want to have even a better understanding of what Racine Vocational Ministries is all about, or ways in which that they can perhaps be of help to it, what should they do?
They could certainly call me. I'd be happy to talk to them. Our number at Racine Vocational Ministry is 633-8660, and I can help them get connected. We have a website that is being redesigned, but the old site still has some good information about who we are, what we've done, and what we're trying to accomplish. And we also have an annual recognition event every year, or just before the holidays, before Christmas, to celebrate some of our successes, and that's open to the public as well. So there are a lot of opportunities to learn about what we're doing, and I encourage people to take a look or to follow our Facebook and to see what's happening.